Good morning once again. You're welcome back to the 9 till noon show. Welcome along if you're just joining us. You missed out on quite an informative and interesting first hour, I think. Just a reminder for you that the show's podcast on our website. It's broken down into 3 hours for you every day. It's available just after 12, around about half past 12. Or you can watch the show back whenever you like on our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland. A caller says, so good to hear such common sense on so many topics this morning instead of legal and political. Another, as for Michelle O'Neill, Sinn Féin would need to look at itself, bowing to the King of England, a step too far, insulting the innocent people of Derry murders by King Charles's army and him, the chief of the para regiment. Another, Michelle is right. She's looking at the bigger picture and looking to a future for all the people, unlike the DUP, who are self-serving. Another, Michelle O'Neill is only going to the coronation to wind up Geoffrey Donaldson, who is missing out. Real mixed views on this topic. A caller says, what about the property tax as well? Unfair tax on your home. We had to pay it. Taken over by revenue. Time the people took to the streets. This government is a joke. Dick Turpin's the lot of them. I've heard no proposals from any other parties, by the way, to remove the property tax now, unless I've missed them. So if you were to remove them, with whom do you replace? Read Charles's coronation. Paddy Tobin's party ain't whose criticism of Michelle O'Neill, designate First Minister in the north of Ireland, shows us what a one-trick pony political party they are, in my opinion. Ms O'Neill said from the start she would be First Minister for all. There's politics at play here too. I'm not questioning Paddy Tobin's motivations, but of course they are contesting elections in Northern Ireland in a number of seats in the next month, and maybe they feel that if they take that stance, it might play to a wider audience. Relating to your conversation with Father Bradley earlier and his interview with Greg, yes, totally agree with his view on mobile phones and the internet. This interview has targeted all the right angles, but it's up to the parents and teachers to address this toxic issue. Hi, Greg. That councillor is 100%. Leave farmland for farming and their families. There are too many things in the pipeline that our so-called government is trying to introduce that it's not getting the attention it deserves. There's nothing in it for the local person, the local farmer. Only grief. RTDs have shown time and time again they are not there to support their people, only developers, investors, bankers or corporate. People don't hear what's happening, so they can't react in time. Hi, Greg. Did you hear any news about Revolut? Looking for your PPS number for June. This will finish Revolut with me. Thank you. They have to have your PPS number, apparently. Now, when I say they have to, just to be clear, I'm not defending Revolut or saying it's the right thing to do. I'm just saying this is what they say. Because of the potential for money laundering and scams, they say that they are required by law to have the PPS number. I presume the other banks have it as well. They are now obviously providing Irish IBAN numbers, and presumably another set of rules and oversight from the central bank requires them to seek your PPS number. They asked for mine a couple of months ago, but presumably as it relates to money laundering. I mean, talking about money laundering and all that kind of stuff, I went into the post office a couple of weeks ago, spoke with a lovely lady. Don't get me wrong, this is nothing to do with her. But I was surprised, dare I say even shocked, that to get a money order, it was €65, you have to provide your, you have to sign a document and your date of birth. You have to provide your date of birth just to transfer €65 into a money order. And again, that's down for money laundering rules and all, but you know, they'll argue what it's for. But I can't believe that this day and age, just to transfer €65 in cash to a money order, that you have to provide such personal information as your date of birth. I didn't mind because I don't really feel I have anything to hide. I've got very little privacy on my phone in terms of what companies can access because I don't really care. But for others, it would be a big deal. That's why I mentioned it. Okay, so we have been talking about electricity prices for a long time now. No sign of them coming down, seemingly. And people have been getting bills recently for really big amounts. Well, I thought they were big, and they were big, but nothing compared to what we're going to talk about now. I've been chatting to people off air and on who've received bills, 7, 8, 9, 100 euro, 1,000 euro, and what have you. But as I say, that pales almost, I wouldn't say to insignificance, because it's very significant to the people involved, but it's nothing really compared to what the bill that dropped onto Martin's doormat. Good morning to you, Martin. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you doing, Greg?
I'm all right. I don't know how I would feel, though, if I received this bill that you received for your electricity, especially considering I'm not really having to go through everything that you're going through at the moment, because you have a defective concrete home and you received a recent bill for electricity. And what was that bill?
We got a bit of a holy moly. We got a bit of a good a shock. That was the start of January. We have one of the defective blocked houses. And now, to be fair about it, our house is becoming increasingly hard to heat as of late. So our prices have been creeping up. There's no doubt about that. But on the start of January, and I'll always remember it, it was on a Friday, probably 4 or 5 o'clock, probably too late for me to call. But anyway, I remember that. Open up the letter and we got a bill for electricity for $3,189.79. I'm going to be totally honest. I didn't really... I got a bit of a shock, but I wasn't one bit worried about it. I thought, okay, it's obviously a mistake. So there's not a lot I can do until Monday morning, so I'll give them a shout on Monday. So I did give them a shout on Monday, and geez, Greg, within 2 minutes, within 30 seconds, that was my bill. Apparently, I was estimated in September, October, November, December. They read it in January, and that was my bill.
Wow.
Now, I do appreciate and I do realise I have a heat pump. It works in the electricity because we have a night meter. So it's heating the house during the night. I can tell you that the switch in the wall of that has actually been switched off since we went in about 1,000 litres of oil. But I was also out of contract with them, she informed me. Now, the person was lovely. They helped me as much as they could. So I was out of contract, so I had no discount. So she applied all them right back to when it did go out, which brought my bill down to just north of 2,800.
Now, so in relation to that, Martin, how many months did that cover?
4 months.
Okay.
I couldn't understand it. I said, listen, there has to be a mistake. I said, could it be a problem with the meter? So she actually pointed me in the direction of the ESB that, yes, you can get your meter tested. They'll come out, they'll remove your meter, they'll take it away. I think it's either for 7 or 11 weeks they put it onto this machine to calibrate it to see if it's going okay. If it's deemed that there's something wrong with it, it's calculated, you get your return. If there's nothing wrong with it, you pay ESB €180, I think, for their trouble to come out and do that for you. We didn't do it. We just took it on the head. We ended up paying for it. And that's our bill, just north of $2,800. For that period. Couldn't possibly believe it. I was gobsmacked.
But
Martin,
what do you think is eating the electricity so much? It couldn't be the heat pump, could it, on night time? Are you having to use wee storage heaters and stuff in different rooms?
No, we're not. We haven't got to that stage yet, no. We're not using storage heaters or anything like that. I asked how in the name of God could I possibly use that much electricity? So they all pointed me in the direction of the heat pump. Now, I know there was a cold snap, but of course, no, we've had colder because there's a little unit that sits outside the house, and when it gets below a certain temperature, it'll always obviously bring it on. But you notice I didn't even contact the people that put it in for me to see to come out. I've just switched it off at the wall. No heat pump. We went and got 1,000 litres of oil.
Yeah.
And that's what we're using at the moment.
All
and
right.
Did you see the WhatsApp? I've just sent it while I was waiting to talk to you. If you look at my WhatsApps there, I've got another bill. For the last period, I wrote it up in the kitchen. What, for 683
€693.88. That's for 2 months, is it?
That's for 2 months.
That's
for January now in February. So that's my bill that has just arrived with me today, €693.88. I don't know where I'm going wrong. I think I'm going to have to do something with the ESB to come out to check my meter or something, because there's no... We're on the night meter saver, dishwasher, our washing machine and everything is put on a delayed timer. That's done during the night. Our house is just a wee bit over 2,000 square foot. It's not like we're heating a small bloody castle. But it's just absolutely... Electricity at the minute is crippling us now.
This is still particularly high. I mean, I think I'm kind of average. You know, there's a number of TVs on in the house. I'm constantly asking people to turn off lights. You know yourself. Stopped using the dryer as much as possible, but sometimes you still have to. But my bill is I think my last one was 388, which is far shy of your 700, Martin. I mean, that's just astronomical. No one can absorb those types of costs. So you've paid effectively you know, over $3,000 for electricity for 5 months.
Yes. And I've the WhatsApp. I've WhatsApped my account number to show you, to show that I'm not making it up.
You've oh, no, I don't doubt it.
Of the bill.
Yeah.
I didn't even get talking to my wife yet about it, but geez, we seem to be absolutely crippled with electricity. Even listening to your two callers coming up. Do you know this? I think we're just being slowly chipped at all the time. These companies are showing huge profits and allowing the prices to rise with absolutely no accountability whatsoever. Well, here we are. Now, I know there's probably, and I know there has to be people sitting out there with the same dilemma as that we're in at the minute, but where do you go?
I don't know.
The lady was talking about Switcher and doing this and that, and I did. I wouldn't be the quickest person to pick up on that, but I did contact a good few of them. The prices that I would have been, or the saving that I would have been making, would have been no more than maybe 150 to 200 euro over the year. Now, it's Energia that I'm with at the moment, which would have been always fairly, would have been there or thereabout. I know there's not a, well, maybe there is a difference, but I couldn't see a huge difference. But listen, that's where we're at. Listen to you, I know this, I think our politicians and our local representatives needs to be doing, I know this is a nationwide thing, but prices of everything, and we're in every department, we're being chipped and chipped away at all the time. Geez, Greg, if this was to happen in France, do you know this? There'd be uproar in the streets. Mm. There'd be uproar.
Well, you we are paying, and as you know, and it's triggered all of this, we're paying the highest electricity in Europe. We are 4 or 5 times the lowest. We are 50% above the average. What's going on? Where's our representation on this stuff, Martin? You know, they're in arguing Correct. About not unimportant things in the door, but what about this? Like, this is crippling people. That type of a bill. I don't know, Martin, if you come across as you come across in your voice and the way you're speaking to me to some extent as you can take things in your stride, and perhaps you have to with everything you're going through with the house and everything. But for some people to get that bill, I don't know what impact it might have on them. And then to get another bill then for 700, even after switching off your heating overnight, and on top of all of that, to be in a house that's deteriorating all the while, getting no help from banks, I presume, no help from the government as of yet. We'll see what comes from that. I mean, it's just one thing after another for you, Martin. I don't know how you can stay, you know, so sounding so upbeat. And I'm not trying to bring you down. I admire you, and I wish I could take some of it from you. But, like, it's one,
I can
it literally
assure you,
is one thing
I'm
after
not
another.
Upbeat.
Right, okay, okay. It's just, yeah, okay, I get you.
I'm not one bit upbeat about it. It's just, yes, with regards to our politicians and not being represented, that is definitely it. And particularly, I know this is nationwide, but particularly in Donegal, do you know this? We're far too nice up here. Mm. We need to be represented and we need to be heard at the table a lot stronger and a lot harder than what we are. We're just too caught up. Our own TDs, our own politicians are all too caught up in the family, the party whip. And they're afraid of ruffling feathers, and I think that's why there's leaving us, a lot of us, where we are today. Mm. Now, don't be under any illusion that we're taking this in our stride. Yes, we've got a lot. I've spoken to you about Micah, or not to you, Micah at that time, but Defective Concrete now before. But I can assure you, we're not taking it. We're self-employed now. We've four young family, and even before we got our core sampling done, that was last year. I got my core sampling done on December the 13th. Mm-hmm. My wee girl was turning her 8th birthday. 3 days before that, my wife organised a party in Derry, and we were going to go in for something to eat. We went to the Mass in the Cathedral, and I didn't feel great that morning, but anyway, I went to Mass in the Cathedral, hoping to go into Derry after that to celebrate her birthday. It was the day of her 8th birthday. And ended up coming out in an ambulance. I was actually anointed coming out the door. Just took some kind of a panic attack or something. Believe me, the stress and the anxiety that's with it is palpable. So hence the reason I haven't been on talking. I'm not a public speaker. I can only tell my own story, and if that helps somebody else, or if somebody else can relate to it, great.
Okay.
But the pressure.
Are you feeling okay, Martin? Because I think that at that time the pressure pot was just at its maximum, and the lid went. Just for context for this electricity situation, and I don't know why we're being treated like we are. Wholesale electricity prices, so that's the price that, these companies buy the electricity at, fell by 41% in the final 3 months of last year compared to the previous quarter. Electricity prices were 17% cheaper compared to the last 3 months of 2021, right? Now, we're still getting these massive, massive bills. And we hear Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, Taoiseach at the time, sat opposite me and said, well, we can't do this and we don't know if we can do that and this, that and the other. And they join us and say it's terrible what's going on. But if a government, any government, this government or whatever government, can't intervene to at least get some fairness for us, well, then what is it all about? Whomever it is, I don't care if it's Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, Sinn Féin, ain't to, it doesn't matter. But they are there to scream from the rooftops to say that you can get electricity now on the open markets for 17% than you could at the end of 2021. And then there's people like yourself, Martin, who are receiving bills for over €3,000 and having to put up with that and everything else that's going on. Like, what is going on in this country?
You've hit the nail on the head there. So where do you go? What do you say to that? What do any councillors say to that? What does any TD or politician say to that? Are they being listened to? They might be in the party, but are they actually being listened to? And if they're in there, what the bloody hell are they doing? Look at us. They're very welcome to come here and have a look at where we're living. Look at the state of our house. Now, I know there's probably houses that are a lot worse off than us.
You don't have to apologise with what you're going through, Martin. But, I understand that, and I know it's in your nature, but this is your experience.
What I'm annoyed about is why isn't somebody actually doing something about it? You know, we're not only just this, but we're slowly being chipped away at all this land. You're talking about the farmers, the zoning of the land, the fishing, everything. We're just being chipped away at all the time, constantly. Gee, at what point does it actually stop? And do people actually stop worrying about things and live life?
That's a really important point. How can you, when you've so much going on around you, even the most normal events take on a whole different meaning, don't they?
You're running past your family.
The joy of being a parent. You know, where do you get the brain space for that? Not you personally, Martin. I mean, all of us. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, just the simple stuff that, as we grind out what we're grinding out. And also, that 1,000 litres of oil is not going to last forever either, and that's going to be another bill that's coming down the line. While you've
I'm
got
probably a, down to about... I checked it last night. Well, I know it's down a wee bit at the minute, but I checked it and we're on about 8 inches, so we'll probably have enough for another fortnight. So that did me all just 8.5 weeks. So I'll probably get another week. So I'm probably chatting about 11 weeks for a 1,000 litres of oil.
I'll tell you what I would do, Martin, because I don't trust these people. I'd switch to a pay-as-you-go meter, get them to install it, see how much you're using, and then before the cooling-off period expires, get it taken out again if you don't want it. Because I don't think you can trust the companies to sort of sort this out for you. Maybe that's one way you can monitor it yourself. I don't know.
Well, I'm got it this morning because I did switch my heat pump off in January. Yeah. Off, so I thought, okay, well, if you're causing it, you have to be switched off. So that is switched off. And now just at 10:01, you'll see the time my text came in from Energia and another bill now for €680 for January and February. So, okay, I didn't get a chance. I need to talk to my wife to see what's going forward. But obviously, I don't know. Our ESB bill has gone. I don't know. I'm just at a loss at the minute as to know where to go. It just seems as though we're working to pay electricity at the moment. It's mental. It's absolutely mental. It's totally unsustainable. We couldn't sustain this. We're going to have to do something. But anyway.
All right, Martin.
That's our bill, and I'm sure there's other people out there as well.
And just the coincidence of that €700 bill dropping on the doormat at the same time we're about to talk. It's
yeah.
All right, Martin. Listen.
Somebody must have heard us putting you there.
Yeah.
All right.
I hope there is some resolution soon, and stay strong. It's tough out there. I understand
that. Or if there has been a mistake, or if there's some problem with the meter or something, I'll give you a heads up. At least somebody else might be able to relate to it. But we're going to have to look on to see where all this energy has been used at the moment, or if that's what it is. But if there is anything that jumps out, I'll come back and let you know.
All right, Martin. Love to all the family. Thank you very much indeed for that. I appreciate it. Tommy, listening to Martin there, I mean, shocking stuff. You make a really a good, solid point here, Tommy. Where is the energy regulator?
Yeah, that's right. I've heard the prices of electricity on your show in the past, and I've heard Pearse Doherty chatting in the Dáil about it. But where? You know, I've never heard it mentioned anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, I saw someone yesterday spouting, because that sounds negative. I don't mean it like that. Talking about how last month or 1 month this year, 10% of our power came from solar. You know, another 30, 35% came from wind. We're being told this stuff, and then we're being told that prices are so cheap on the open markets. And yet we've got people like Martin getting these big bills. And who's standing up for the people? It's clearly not the energy regulator, because as you say, Tommy, they're seemingly absent without leave.
Yeah, but like, I don't understand why it likes appears to Hardy, or even yourself in your show, have never mentioned the regulator before.
Yeah, well, listen, hands,
you know,
up. Yeah.
As far as I understood the regulator, when Electric Ireland want a price increase, they have to go through the regulator, and they have to okay it. You know, so I don't get it.
Well, maybe the energy regulator is not working for us. Maybe, you know, I presume then they set the rate that guarantees people who generate electricity through wind the same amount of money you get per unit for if you create it with oil or gas. I don't know. Maybe they're part of the...
Yeah, okay. Look, I don't know. The financial regulator went missing about 10, 15 years ago. And look what happened to the country.
Mm.
So look, it has to be brought up. It has to be brought up in front of the Doyle Committee or whatever, and put through paces.
Whilst I was speaking
Craig,
to you,
just yep. another side thing on what your man was just talking about there about the prices. I watched a little video this morning on YouTube, and this guy, I don't know where he's from, maybe somewhere around the Ballyshannon area, Lahey area, because he mentioned about going to Keys and Lahey and buying a generator. To generate his own electricity, because he said it'll work out cheaper than paying what they're paying at the moment. And this guy, he was charged over €2,700 on a 2 monthly bill. And he got on to the company, and he reckons that they're just targeting random people and charge them what they like.
Mm.
And a big point of his thing was, he says, you've got older people, I've been maybe charged £800-900, and went ahead and paid the bill without even questioning it. Just thinking that's the prices of electricity.
Yeah.
And he says, they've probably been targeted, he says.
Just interesting, while I'm listening to you, and I was listening to you, the Commission for Energy Regulation, which is the group that you talk of, received 12,373 complaints from customers last year about energy and water issues. Now, did they act upon them? How many of us actually go to the bother of making such a complaint? As you say, what are they going to do about it? And we'll put an inquiry into them. And you're right, hands up. Have we mentioned them? No. Have we called them to account? No. Shall we? Yes. We will, yeah. Tommy. But thank you very much for your input. I appreciate it. All right, take care of yourself.
Okay,
thanks, Tommy.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Well, thanks, Greg. Bye-bye.
No, it's lovely having you on the show. I appreciate it greatly. That poor man, electric is far too dear. He's right. The people have to stand together on this. Another Martin is right. It's a disgrace. We should be more like the French and get out there. Our government ministers are, well, I have no words. This whilst and trying to get a conversation going last week, not trying to direct the conversation, but get the conversation going. We are living in a country that between last year, this year and next will have an excess. Now, the surplus is beyond what the government was expecting, okay, I believe. It certainly doesn't make up all of it, but certainly part of it. Over 30 billion euro. And we've got people like Martin living in a defective concrete affected home, getting bills of 3,700 and 700 euro for 5 months to cover 5 months for just heating his home. And even though we switched off the electric pump, still for 2 months, 700 euro, which is that's not outside of what I've heard other people talking about, but it's still incredibly high. All right, keep your calls and comments coming in on the various issues we've been discussing this morning. I'll get to them in a moment. But the head of the Northwest Migrants Forum has called for an end to the deeply unfair practice of othering school children who do not identify as Catholic or Protestant. The forum's director of programs, Lillian Senor Barr, was speaking after receiving a heartfelt letter from a 10-year-old Muslim girl. Lillian joins us on the program now. Thank you for joining us, Lillian. It's good to have you on the program. I don't know if your microphone is blocked, but I can't hear you as clearly as I would like. But anyway, we'll proceed and see how we get on. Lillian, talk to me about this young person's experience.
So Yara is an 11-year-old girl, and throughout her primary school, she was taught about diversity and that everyone is equal. And she got a massive shock when she went to apply for secondary school. She learned that religious and ethnic minoritized people were considered other. She was just not shocked. She was very upset and then decided she wanted to do something about it. This is what prompted her to write to me.
And, you know, in some way, in addressing this young person's experience, we can also talk to about how in Northern Ireland, despite all the changes that has happened, there is still not enough integration. It is them, us, others sort of a thing. So really, you know, in addressing this, we maybe could address the situation for an awful lot of children, regardless of their background or what religion they happen to be born into.
Absolutely. 25 years after the Good Friday Agreement, there is so much diversity of thought and diversity of identity in the North of Ireland. And to be honest, identity has always been more than the two communities. But we have remained in the binary of unionism and nationalists and Catholics and Protestants. And we need to move away from language that alienates such a big community that belongs here. Recently, if you see the Lives and Time survey since 2006, it has shown that the largest group in Northern Ireland are not those who identify as nationalist or unionist. They've moved away from that. Mm-hmm. We have mixed communities, mixed religious families. We have people of minoritized communities and young people who are born in this country who want a better future and don't see themselves as reduced to these two boxes of a binary between Catholics and nationalists. So it is something that we need to look into and seriously if we want to build a shared community and a shared future for everyone who lives in the North of Ireland.
Now, this young girl encouraged the Northwest Migrants Forum to make representations on their behalf. And we're doing that now, okay? But unfortunately, we can't make decisions or change policy. So has the forum made representations to government or politicians? When I say government, obviously there's a complication in that regard. But with the powers that be, have representations been made? And what has come back from them, if so?
So what we have done, I received this letter only last week, and the good news is the good relations strategy is being reviewed right now. So we have submitted a feedback on the consultation and highlighted this issue as a very serious issue. And Yara is one who have taken action. There are so many young people we work with in different schools in the North of Ireland who also have a massive problem on this particular issue. But we have also written to all the leaders of every political party today to highlight this issue and ask them to meet with young people from our community to listen to their voices and hear how they feel alienated in the society that they were born into and feel that they can't build a sense of belonging here in the North of Ireland if their identity is not recognized or they're not given the opportunity to express who they are and have to be put on a box of other, which is quite frankly, very diverse in nature in itself.
Yeah. So is there, I wonder then, is there other ways that we catch the population of school children in Northern Ireland? Because I presume in terms of policy approach, where we, you know, how we refine our education system, you kind of want a sense of who you're teaching, don't you? It would be interesting to know how many are you know, Protestant, Catholic, Muslim, whatever religion there might be. Is there somewhere else, I wonder, in the system where we catch the actual makeup of this other group? Because if we aren't, then I think we're missing an opportunity in making sure that we are offering the best education for all children.
Absolutely. I think the best practice just used even just in England here, where people can identify as who they want to, and that is captured through policy. If we move away from sectarian headcounts, we can ask people a straight question. How do you identify? You know, or what religion do you come from? It's not really rocket science. And if people want to identify as Catholic, they might have a space rather than just putting it in a box to say, are you Catholic? Are you a nationalist? Are you unionist? Or are you a Protestant? It's ask a straight question. How do you identify? and people, or what is your ethnicity or what is your religion? And that can be captured. It's happening just across the waters. So why not happen here in the north?
And, you know, we as adults can dig through this all and peel back the layers of the onions and all that kind of stuff. But sometimes the words of the child themselves are the most telling. And I'll read some of the letter here. I'm writing to complain about signing up for the schools. You see, I found it hard to sign up to some schools because of the criteria. As I'm sure you know, it's set into Catholic, Protestant and other. And this is the bit that stood out for me. It's a simple sentence. I refuse to be called other. It isn't nice. So there's no loaded language. There's no massive history there. There's no bias, you know, that she just simply says it's not nice.
Yeah, he just says it's not nice to be othered. And we know othering people is excluding them, is denying them that sense of belonging. And recently there was a research done by the Economic and Social Research Institute, which compared migration patterns in the north of Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. And it highlighted that the second generation of young people living in the old island are twice likely to have poor mental health. This is another issue that really makes it harder for them to feel that they belong here, and it impacts profoundly on their mental health. So we really do need to listen to the voices of these young people and move away from this binary and just let them feel they belong, because Ireland is their home too.
Okay, thank you so much for your time this morning. I appreciate it. Take care of yourself. The line not terribly clear there, but hopefully you were able to hear the points raised there by Lillian Signor Barr, who is the Northwest Migrants Forum's Director of Programmes. And the young girl is simply saying it's Catholic, Protestant. She doesn't want to tick other. Just put a few other options there. What do you think? 08660 25,000. It makes sense to me. I don't know about what you all think. That's why I invited you to text. Okay, some of your comments coming in so far this morning. Martin said his bills were estimated for three times and mentioned being out of contract. This is his problem. He should have read his own meter and not gone out of contract. I don't think it's his problem. I understand where you're coming from. His meter then was eventually read and it confirmed the estimates. I'm currently out of contract with my electricity provider, and the advantage of going back into contract is €100 credit. That's it. There's no other advantage beyond that. There's no advantage in terms of the cost of electricity. There's no deductions, no nothing. And they are the cheapest on the market at the moment. So I take your point. I respect your point, but I'm not sure if that accounts for all of the money we're talking about here. Greg, when buying a couple of hundred sterling in the post office, I was asked for my PPS number. I was told it was required by the central bank. Keep up the good work, they say. Yeah, indeed. That's why people are being asked for their Revolut number. If Electric Ireland dropped their rate to pre-COVID rates, they still would be making €400 million profit. Not too bad, is it? Not too shabby. Another caller said, I got a bill of €2,000 in March because of all the previous bills that had been estimated. I live alone and I cannot pay this extra. They arrived at my door to cut me off. Despite me paying each bill, they sent me on time. I ended up having to get a loan to pay it off. Well, that again is completely sounds completely unfair. Can you imagine having to get a loan out to pay your electricity bill? I'm sure many of you can because you're perhaps having to do it, but that is not right. Okay. Let's talk history now. It is time for Talking History with Dr. Joe Kelly, our resident historian. Good morning to you, Joe. How are you keeping?
Good morning to you all and yourself and to all on Highland Radio.
It's great to have you back on the show again. We're talking about the history of the Gardaí, really, effectively, aren't we?
Yeah, there's a very interesting history of policing in Ireland for the number of centuries. And we're commemorating this year 100 years of the formation of the Garda Síochána. They were named such in 1923, August 1923. So we've had 100 years of the Gardaí. And previous to that, we had other police forces in Ireland when we were colonised. So there's a long history there.
How far back do you want to go? Should we start with the Royal Irish Constabulary, which, of course, the An Garda Síochána effectively replaced? Or do you want to dig a little bit further back?
Well, maybe we think of it in the context before actually the English arrived in Ireland and colonised us. We didn't really have a policing system as such. And we talked before about early Irish law and the Brehon law. It was a self-regulated and self-disciplined society. And if somebody broke the law, a codified law, then there was a punishment a fine paid by the individual, and if the individual couldn't pay it, it was paid by the family, and the family couldn't pay it, the community would pay it. So that was the system we had, and it was a very interesting policing
system. Right, well,
system.
Let's set a scenario in, right? I'm making my own potsheen, right? I'm selling it all over the place in my local village. I'm locked all the time. Everyone about me is locked. We're fighting, we're robbing, we're doing all of that. We're in the mid-19th century, let's say. There's no police. What's going on? How do we keep law and order?
Yeah, well, what happened then from what you could say, first of all, very interesting, is back in ancient Irish times, it wouldn't have been potsheen, it would have been mead. And the beautiful thing about making alcohol from honey is there's no hangover. It's a natural alcohol, so to speak, and fermenting. So maybe we could go back to that and have less sore heads.
How do you spell mead? No, I'm only joking. Go ahead.
Honestly, people Googling now how to make it. And we're putting the bars out of business. But no, you're right about that there. How did this regulate? And there was punishments laid down by the Braves. But as we moved into colonised times, and really with the arrival of 1171 of Henry II, the King of England, his son then was made the Earl of Hibernia in 1177. He started to build Dublin Castle. And with that establishment of Dublin Castle, which is very symbolic of British policing of Ireland, from 1177 to 1922, we have a colonial system of policing. But it wasn't an organised policing system as we would know today. It evolved over time. And initially what they had, say, in urban areas were night watchmen. They were called Charlies. And they only worked at night, and they had kind of hooks to catch people. They would have to go walk around at night and say hour at 12 o'clock and cloudy evening. They would shout out the weather. They had little like cricket sounding sticks that if there was a noise, rattles, they would spin the rattle around, and that would alert all the other night watchmen to get the thieves. And that was the kind of system. But they were only part-time. And you're correct, it was only then subsequently, you're talking with what they call the Police Preservation Force, which was established by Robert Peel, who was the Prime Minister of England, but he was in Ireland as the Lord Lieutenant, about 1812. And he established this force, and it was the first policing force in either Ireland or England at the time. It was a professional permanent force, and it was based mostly in Dublin, and that's why often, you know, in our national anthem you'll hear a taffy lav na biller, the guns that are in the hands of the peelers, and it's Robert Peel, the Prime Minister. So sometimes you might hear the police being called, the guardian called the peelers in Irish, particularly in the Irish language. It goes back to Robert Peel.
So well, how would that have been accepted, I wonder, by the population, in that, you know, it's a new concept. We're borning into it, so it's very easy. But they're going, what gives you the right to, who gives you the right to tell me what I can do and what I can't do? I mean, do we know if there was much of a pushback on it, or did maybe people welcomed it because, you know, they thought, right, there's a lot of lawlessness and now we have some order? I don't know. I wonder what their attitude was.
Well, the population of Ireland would have been somewhat different to as it is today. And it would be much more rural than urban, if that makes sense. So for the urban areas, they would have welcomed peace and security, if that was, you know, a concern for people. Other than that, there, it wasn't really affecting their lives if they were carrying on as normal, so to speak. But what they had in the counties where there would be riots or anti-agrarian, anti-landlord movements, they would have a county police that they moved around from place to place. They weren't permanent. That didn't happen really to the formation of the Irish Constabulary, which led to the Royal Irish Constabulary. And you're talking from really 1822 on, this organised police force was established, and they had about 1,400 barracks throughout the whole length and breadth of Ireland. And this then became the structuring of policing that we've come to know even today. It's the idea of it local, permanent, professionally trained, educated men and women now, at that time men, and they had about 8,500 men, RIC or Irish Constabulary men, about 1840s, and that number grew to about 10,000, 12,000.
Well, you're mentioning the Irish Constabulary, and the Royal Irish Constabulary. Was the Royal added later, and if so, why?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. They were known as the Irish Constabulary initially, and then they were called the Royal Irish Constabulary after 1867. There was a Fenian rising in 1867, and the constabulary had played a major role in suppressing that rising. So Queen Victoria honoured the Irish Constabulary with the title Royal. So then it became the Royal Irish Constabulary. And we know later on when they were disbanded in 1922 in the six counties, it became known as the RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary.
Now, when we talk about them being disbanded, though, I presume some members of the RIC then became members of the Free State Gardaí. Like, how big of a transition from the one force to the other? I mean, was the new police effectively just a new name, or was it a root and branch change?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and it was a very controversial question. And one must remember, you know, we'd been with the War of Independence, 1919 to 1921. There was an effort to refuse to cooperate in any way with anything British in our country, be it the court system, be it supplying the police with turf, isolating, boycotting the police. So you could say for 3 years, from 1919 to 1921, there was no policing in Ireland. That it had fallen apart because people in Ireland weren't accepting the RIC, which was seen as a British rule in Ireland, weren't accepting that anymore. So when we got independence in 1922 with the disbandment of the RIC, the problem was, how are we going to restore order? And there still were crimes during the War of Independence. How are we going to restore order to a society that has been more or less lawless or unpoliced for 3 years? And it did create a lot of difficulties, because when the RIC initially disbanded, IRA men had moved into the various barracks and taken them over, and they kind of kept a policing presence. But Collins took a jaundiced view of these men, in the sense that they weren't professional, they weren't trained, and he was concerned that they wouldn't be disciplined. So he decided, look, we need to do something about forming a new police service in the new Free State. And so at the time, the minister of the time, Kevin O'Higgins, asked the TDs, could you recommend former RIC officers that were sympathetic towards the Irish to help us form this new police? Now, that went against the grain with a lot of men that had been fighting the RIC and shooting at them, and the black and tans and all that, and saying, here, what now? You're going to take some of these men in to form our new Gardaí? And about 180 former RIC men were given senior roles within the formation of the new Gardaí, to help them, shape them. And one of them actually was a Letterkenny man, Patrick Walsh, and he became the assistant commissioner. And it was McGinley, he was the TD, Dr. McGinley. That would be Niall McGinley, the historian, well-known Donegal historian. His father recommended Patrick Walsh to Michael Collins. Mm. And Michael Collins wrote to Patrick Walsh asking him, would he come to Dublin to meet, to help form the new Gardaí, or the new Civic Guard, as it
was. And what do we know about Patrick Walsh?
Yes, well, as I said, Dr. McGinley, Dr. Joseph McGinley, who was a pro-treaty TD, had recommended to Collins and to Higgins, the ministers at the time, that Patrick would be very favourable towards the Irish Free State. And he used an example from his own experience where there was an incident, an IRA attack, in which Dr. McGinley himself was involved in. And Patrick Walsh arrived to his house with the officers and said, look, three men were discovered and one of them fits your description. And he moved through the house and he could find some Sinn Féin literature. And he says, if you were, if this was found, you know, you'd be going to jail. Mm-hmm. And he got rid of it. And he let Dr. Sweeney away, if that's so to speak. So Dr. Sweeney never forgot that. And he realised that this RIC man was actually very favourable towards the Republican cause. And so when the shoe was on the other foot in an independent Ireland, Dr. McGinley recommended him highly, and Michael Collins wrote to Patrick Walsh, and in fact he signed the letter Micheál O'Collins, which is very interesting. So Patrick went to Dublin. He was actually a Monaghan man who had been in charge of the RIC in Letterkenny, and he worked very hard in establishing the Garda Síochána, the format, the discipline, the education, and he served two commissioners. And he served up to 1936.
Wow.
And it was a very, very, it seemed to be a very honourable, noble, just man. And it was very interesting that Owen O'Neill, the second commissioner, said that He was so good to go to for advice, such experience, such forthrightness. And he obviously had shaped what would become the future Gardaí as we
well,
come to...
Well, that's one element of that which intrigues me. Only this week, interviewing the representative from the Garda Representative Association on the conversation of whether or not Gardaí should have tasers. And during the course of that conversation, he said, and he said it before, Brendan O'Connor, that is, that the Garda force is very proud that it's an unarmed force. The RIC were an armed force, were they not? So why did we then transition from the RIC, an armed force, into An Garda Síochána Síochána, which is unarmed? I presume it was unarmed from the start, and yet here we are 100 years later. They're still proud of that, but still having conversations about some level of armament.
Brilliant question, an absolutely brilliant question, and I'll tell you why. Believe it or not, the what was a civic guard for a while, it was called then the Garda Síochána, it was renamed. It was actually initially an armed police force.
Uh-huh.
And what happened was, you've got to remember the Civil War was going on, and there was a mutiny in May 1922 in Kildare in the training station for the Gardaí, what would become the new Gardaí. And the state were a little bit afraid that if these armed Gardaí, they could go one way or the other with the state. And so they decided to not arm them after the mutiny that lasted for 11 weeks. A lot of the new recruits didn't look very favourably towards these former RIC officers being in command, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a fear that they might actually, you know, lead to another revolution or, you know, the anti-treaty side and so forth. So they actually became unarmed after that mutiny in 1922, in May 1922.
So that was with an abundance of caution in case there was some sort of a rebellion or uprising or something. They took the guns off them because why would they have a ready-made army out there if they took a notion to rise?
Yes. And that was one of the concerns. Now, historians would have a different perspective because some would traditionally believe that the Garda Síochána was what they were renamed. They were initially called the Civic Guard, a temporary name for a year, and then the Garda Síochána, which was a name actually given by another Letterkenny RIC officer, Matthias McCarthy, who served as an RIC officer in Letterkenny. In 1937, he'd written an article and claimed that it was he that offered the name Garda Síochána, which is... come back to what you said, it's a very unique name, the Keepers of Peace. And maybe this is where we're coming to celebrate 100 years of the Gardaí. Ireland has a very unique view of policing insofar as they're unarmed, as you point out. But our guards aren't police as such. They're Garda Síochána. Síochána means peace. They're keepers of the peace. And the purpose of Gardaí in the formation of the early state was that they were to keep the peace. And if you keep the peace, there's no need to enforce the law. Then that leads to maybe some of the questions. Are we resourcing our Gardaí sufficiently?
Is that ethos still there? Is that why sometimes we see what people... Gardaí at attending something but not necessarily getting involved? Do you know what I mean? So to some extent, is that just a happenstance of modern Ireland now? Or is there... Surely it's not still a reflection of the initial sort of ethos of the An Garda Síochána, is it?
I think so. And I've heard the superintendent in my own area speak and others about Michael Staines, who was the first commissioner, who said, look, policing the Garda Síochána does not work by force or by use of arms, but by moral authority. And I really do think we need at some stage to have a citizens' assembly about our Gardaí. And so far as it only works at the present, unarmed Gardaí, if we all buy into that. See, these people are unarmed and trying to enforce or keep the peace, number one, and then on occasions enforce the law. And they're unarmed. And the only way this works is if we buy into it and say, yes, we give you the authority to enforce the law of this country, to regulate this country. But our society is changing very rapidly. I mean, there's been 89 Gardaí killed over the history of the state. The last one was Mayo Guard there back in, I think it was 2021, you know, shot dead. No gun, nothing to protect them.
And so another then in 2016, I think, as well. So, but I don't think now is a good time to have that citizens' assembly because of everything that's been going on and a lot of people's attitudes towards An Garda Síochána. I think the last 3 or 4 years have changed an awful lot of, not an awful lot, but certainly some opinion out there. So what was the early duty of the Gardaí? Because they had some peculiar kind of responsibilities in a modern context anyway.
Absolutely. As far as from video cams and from all those things we talk about and guard the car and patrolling, the things that they did was very, very, they were very basic to the community, and the Gardaí lived in the community or in the barracks. And just to point out, you know, we still call some of the police stations barracks.
Oh, yeah.
But they're not barracks, because barracks is a military institution. It's by default we say that, and everybody does. It's a military institution which was armed. And there's a great book by Walter Macklin called The Scorching Wind. And the two brothers are either side of the Civil War. And one says there's 600 years of history between a police station and a barracks. A police station, in our case, is a non-armed station. A barracks was a military institution. And it's interesting that the RIC always had a barracks. The English always thought that we control Ireland by arms. Mm-hmm. As for today, we have a totally different concept. So when the Gardaí were initiated and started off in 1922, it was very much community policing. So they had to take, funny enough, they had to get a list of, record the rainfall and the weather. They had to talk, note businesses. They had to note down who had bulls, note down who had licenses for dances and for pubs. They had to note down who were vagrants, who were visiting the people.
I've heard stories of, and it's not that long ago, Gardaí getting involved in what was being grown on land. Now, I'm not talking about weed or stuff like that there, but particular species of plants. The Gardaí, that must then be connected to the sort of historic role of the Gardaí then.
Yeah, well, you'd have the different departments of agriculture would have given instructions that certain weeds could be grown and not grown and things like that. There was a famous case in Dunfanaghy that somebody had taken a budgie back on holidays. And I remember he's dead now, Finbar Barrett telling me, and he was a sergeant, local sergeant, and the department had found out that there was this budgie or canary in Dunfanaghy that shouldn't have been there. Now, you're going back the 1950s. And so Paddy Tunney, who was a Letterkenny man, I think he was in charge of the environment or the Department of Agriculture, whatever it was. And he was sent down and told, look, we have to get rid of this budgie. And the order was given to the Gardaí to kill the budgie. This was the kind of the minor issues of life that was concerned.
Did they do it?
Yeah, but one of the very interesting things in my research of the Gardaí, and there was various records kept. In fact, they kept about 24 different types of books or records, but one of them that I found very interesting was the School Attendance Act of 1926, where the Gardaí had to do a weekly and then a monthly report on students missing school. Mm. Now, school would have been very different to what we know now, but students were missing. And I read through the books to look at why they were missing. And excuses were as follows: potato gathering, working at cows, hired in poor circumstances, helping with the threshing, minding a child, death of another child. So, you know, reasons why kids weren't at school. And the Gardaí had to note these things down, which I thought was very interesting. It gives you a very...
And to some extent, some of that still happens now as well in terms, you know, if you're from a farming background. Right. OK, we just have to, I know you've got things to get to, as do we, but there's so much in here. So in terms of Garda numbers now compared to when the Gardaí were formed, where are we at? Because obviously it's a completely different country.
Yeah, well, initially it was about 4,500. It's now up, as my recent records of 2023 is 4,157. And that will have to grow because the population of Ireland is growing. So it's certainly a major change in role and the numbers, and certainly a lot of challenges in that. You know, and you mentioned earlier on GSOC, which was set up in 2007 to investigate complaints. And then you have the policing authority that was set up in 2016. To, you know, the strategy of the Gardaí and planning going forward, there's that as well.
And here we are in 2023 with the investigators being investigated themselves.
The Gardaí are different to they're no different to any other institution, be it lawyers, be it a teacher, be it, there are always and always will be people that overstep the mark and do wrong.
And very finally, Dr. Kelly, before I let you go, often when we talk about history, we talk about how the public would gather together in numbers and be a threat to government, even in a violent way. We'd never want to see a return to that. I don't think most won't. But the government was actually fearful that the people could be unhappy and could fight them back, overthrow them, change them, whatever it might be. Is there a point in history where we lost that, where we became complicit, complacent, whereby we just stopped really even caring about some of the most big things in life? Like, we've been chipped away, when you think about it, to a big flock of sheep. Not all people, because I don't want to judge everyone in, don't get me wrong. But at what point along the history, we're only talking 100 years ago, we're talking about granddads, grandfathers and stuff. Yeah. At what point along the way did we lose the bottle that we just become servants or subservient?
Well, I think, first of all, and there's nothing really to do with the Gardaí as such. They're just doing a job.
No, completely unrelated to... Sorry, this is unrelated. This is a completely separate question based on a lot of conversations we had on various different elements of history over the years.
Well, I would say, for one, and I'm just maybe talking from my own personal experience, we're so busy trying to live and pay bills, get on with life, children, so on and so forth, that we don't have time at times to put energy into changing things, and we're being forced to accept a lot of things in life because we don't have the energy or the time to try to fight these things. But look, it's coming to a point where people have to decide, you know, what it is they want and what's a priority for them. And maybe we've realised that politics, if politicians thought for a minute that votes would change things, they wouldn't give us a vote. I don't believe changing one party for another party for another party. The system itself is the problem, and we are all part of the system. Just think of this for 1 minute. 80 people own more money than half the population of the world. Imagine that half of the population were to rise out tomorrow morning. Those 80 wouldn't be able to control it. If we were to divide all the money of the world equally, everybody would be a millionaire. But we've become complacent. We've become silent. We've given away our desire to fight for a better world, a better country. And I don't know where we got complacent along that way. And maybe what we need is someone, maybe one person. You know, Seamus Heaney is a lovely poem. One of our presidents, May Robinson, used it when she became president. History says, don't hope on this side of the grave. But then once in a lifetime, that tidal wave of justice can rise and hope and history rhyme. Maybe once in life, maybe within our lifetime, someone will come along and lead people and say, we deserve a better world, a better country, a better government, a better system. And people buy into that. And maybe that would be the beginning of the change. But until such time, unfortunately, that we get a leader like that, we're going to be where we are because we're too busy trying to live life. And we need to have someone that we can trust, that's honest, that's clear. And so maybe I don't know where we become complacent or how we became complacent. I do trust people. I genuinely do believe. And here in Donegal, we've voted no to a lot of referendum. We don't put up with it here in Donegal. And we fight. We've always had that fighting spirit. And maybe at a national level, housing, health, everything else, I don't know how we're going to solve it. We all know there's a problem, but we mustn't lose hope. We mustn't lose hope. We can change it. It's our country, and we can fight for a better country for our children at all times.
Yeah, till we get to a point where we're actually living and not existing, because sometimes it feels like it's an existence and you get a level of contentment to exist. But are you truly living? Are you truly happy? I don't know. Dr. Joe Kelly, sorry for throwing that one at you at the end. I really appreciate it, but I wanted to get your view on it. Have a lovely day. Take care of yourself. Okay,